So today is the first day, first country residency seminar of the year, and you have Edward Wilson-Emin. You tell us about bouncing cosmologies from condensates of quantum field.
All right, well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. So my goal today is to extract cosmology from quantum gravity, and specifically loop quantum gravity. And here I really mean starting from the full theory, so not looking at some symmetry-reduced mini-superspace model. So of course, we've done a lot of work on loop quantum cosmology. And in this case, this is where we use the quantization techniques of loop quantum gravity and apply these to symmetry-reduced mini-superspaces that correspond to the homogeneous spacetimes that we're interested in. And this has given some potentially important insights into quantum gravity effects in the early universe. But despite the successes that LQC has offered, we still don't know the exact relation between it and full loop quantum gravity. And so what I want to do today is to try and go beyond LQC and figure out how we can extract cosmology from full loop quantum gravity, but using hints that we may have learned along the way from developing LQC. So I think everyone here knows this, so I'll go over this very quickly. It's just to emphasize the main points that I'll be using in this talk from loop quantum gravity. So as you all know, this is a background independent approach to quantum gravity, which is based on connection and triad variables. And a convenient basis for states in the canonical framework are spin networks. So something like this, where your graphs are colored by spins on the edges and intertwiners on the nodes. Now, the main thing that I'll be using in this talk is that geometrical observables, like the volume and the area, have a discrete spectrum. And furthermore, what's really important is that each node can be thought of as a polyhedron with some volume and surface areas transverse to the lengths. And so, for example, if you have a four-valent node, this would correspond to a tetrahedron. And in this sense, the spin network is composed of quantum geometry. So if we look at this picture here, I have one spin network node here, and this would correspond to one quantum geometry with some volume localized at this node, and then you have surface areas which are transverse to the links that leave from that node. So you can think of this as some polyhedron with some volume inside and then surface areas on the surfaces. Now, I want to use this picture in cosmology. So I want to make some assumptions about what types of states are most relevant when we're looking at cosmology. So if you have any theory, like loop quantum gravity, which predicts that your spacetime is constituted of Planck-scale quantum geometry, there are a number of reasonable assumptions that you can make, at least for cosmological spacetime. So first, you'd expect that there'd be many quanta of geometry, that we don't have one single cosmological-sized quanta of geometry. Also, we would expect that each quanta contributes only a small fraction of the total spatial volume. And finally, we can have cosmological expansion in two ways. You could either have the individual quanta that each individually become bigger, or you could have an increasing number of quanta of geometry. And we would expect that cosmological expansion, in this case, is primarily due to quanta being added. And this is particularly important in the context of inflation. Because if you have inflation, then we know that at the onset of inflation, the entire observable universe wasn't much bigger than the Planck scale. So you'd only have a few quanta of geometry corresponding to our observable universe. So today, since we know that our observable universe is composed of more than just a handful of quanta of geometry, then we expect that the cosmological expansion is primarily due to these quanta being added rather than the individual quanta becoming larger themselves. Any questions about this?
Should be one quantum, not one quanta.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And on top of this, so these are just general considerations that I think apply for any theory that predicts that spacetime is constituted of Planck-scale quantum geometry. But on top of this, for loop quantum gravity, we have some experience looking at loop quantum cosmology, and we've gained, I think, some insight from that. And one of the things that loop quantum cosmology suggests is that if at some time you have n quanta of geometry, LQC suggests that, in fact, these n quanta are in the same state and that each contributes the same volume to the total spatial volume. So the total spatial volume at some instant of time is just given by the number of quanta times the volume of each quanta. And each quanta here is suggested to be in the same state. So let me explain this a little bit more before going on by going back to loop quantum cosmology. So one of the key steps when you're constructing the theory is to define the field strength operator. And the fundamental operators that you have in this theory are holonomies of the Ashgar-Barbero connection. So what's most natural to do is to express your field strength in terms of the holonomy of the connection around a small loop. And then your field strength is just given by this relationship here. So you have the holonomy minus the identity. Then you divide that by the area of the loop. And that gives you a measure of the field strength. Now, of course, in lattice gauge theories, you then want to take the limit of the area of this loop going to zero. But this isn't what you want to do in LQC, because the spectrum of the area operator in LQG is discrete. So this limit of sending the area to zero just doesn't exist in LQG. So what do you do instead? Well, instead, you choose this area to be the minimal area in LQG. So heuristically, what you can think of is that you have your cosmological space. Here I'm talking about a spatial surface. And you just choose some surface in it, which I show here.
Spatial surface, you mean a surface in a space at different times? So you mean like time-like surface or a space-like surface?
Space-like surface.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's an instant of time.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And I just choose some cut through it. So I have some two-dimensional surface in there. And then through this, I'll have these field lines from the graph in my state. And each of them carry some quanta of area. And what I'm doing is that if I choose the area in this equation previously here to be the minimal one, I'm saying that at each point here, the field strength is obtained by going around this plaquette corresponding to this minimal excitation of the area. And what this means is that I'm assuming that the dominant contribution to the area of any surface in my cosmological spacetime comes from having many, many of these minimal area excitations. Right? So if I have some surface, then the area here is given by many excitations of spin 1/2 here, as opposed to just one with a large spin, which would give me a large area. Right? So this is more or less what I explained before. But in LQC, you furthermore make the assumption that they're all in the minimal excitation. And since these are all identical, this suggests, or LQC suggests, that the states in LQG that would correspond to cosmological spacetimes are those where the dominant contribution comes from quantum geometry that are all in the same state. So this would be a condensate of geometry. Yes?
So why do you assume this exactly?
So this is something that you need to make some assumption to figure out what the area is that you choose here.
So instead of taking to zero, just take it to the minimal possible amount.
Exactly. So the limit of taking this to zero doesn't exist. So you can't do that. So the question is, what do you do instead? And so what has been done in LQC and what works very well is to choose them all to be in this minimal area and then set the area to be equal to that. Yeah. Yeah. And so as I said, if all of my excitations are in the same state, then this suggests that the states that are in LQG that correspond to cosmological spacetimes are those that are condensates of geometry.
So can I ask something? So does this mean that this is zero temperature?
I'm not sure what temperature means here.
Everything is in the same state.
That's right.
So it's kind of like a Bose-Einstein kind of thing.
Yes, it is.
That would be zero temperature.
Yeah, I'm a little careful about using temperature there, but yes, it's going to be a Bose-Einstein condensate. And in just a few slides, I'll show you exactly what I mean by the condensate state. So as I briefly reviewed there, loop quantum cosmology suggests that all of the quanta are in the same state. And then this suggests that we should use condensate states to extract cosmology from loop quantum gravity. And this, in turn, directly suggests that we use group field theory. Because if we're working with condensate states, it's very convenient to have creation annihilation operators. And this is what group field theory gives you. It's a formalism of loop quantum gravity, rewritten in a second quantized language, so you have access to these creation and annihilation operators, which will make the mathematical calculations a lot easier. Okay, before getting into the details, I'd like to just go over quickly the idea here of how we're going to go through the rest of this talk. So the key idea is that the continuous cosmological spacetime that we're interested in will emerge from the coarse graining or the hydrodynamics of the group field theory condensate state. So I have some microscopic condensate state defined in my group field theory, and it has some microscopic dynamics. From this, I can extract some effective coarse grained Friedmann equations just by evaluating the dynamics of the collective observables that I'm interested in. So in this case, it'll be, for example, the total spatial volume or the momentum of my scalar field or things like this. And these observables will have some dynamics with respect to some relational time, which will be determined by the microscopic GFT model. And so we'll go into this in detail. And an important point here is that I will, of course, make some assumptions on the state that we're interested in LQG and GFT. So it's going to be a particular type of condensate state. But I'm not going to impose any symmetries on the GFT theory itself. So there are no truncation in terms of the degrees of freedom. Right, so I'm choosing a specific state, but I'm working in the full theory. So here's the outline of what I'll be doing. First, I'll give you a very brief introduction to group field theory with the scalar field. Then I'll show you precisely what I mean by the condensate states. And from these states, I'll extract the effective Friedmann equations, which we can then compare with the Friedmann equations of GR and LQC. OK. So here, I'll work with group field theory with the scalar field. Now, it's important to have a matter field because we're doing cosmology. So we're not that interested in vacuum space times right now. So that's why we have to add a scalar field. And as I already mentioned, group field theory is a second quantized language for loop quantum gravity. And so we have field operators here. So this var phi dagger and var phi, which create and annihilate quantum geometry, which here are spin network nodes. So here we have a lot of labels on these creation annihilation operators. The J's and the M's are your SU2 labels that live on the links of the spin network node. So because there are four of them, these operators create and annihilate four valent spin network nodes. And there's also an intertwiner here, which lives at the node. And we also have a scalar field, which also lives at the node here. So we have a field theory which creates and annihilates the quantum geometry that we're interested in. Now, this will create these nodes individually. And then if you create two of them and you want to connect them somehow, then you act with various projectors on your two-body state. But I won't go into the details here because that won't be necessary for what I'm talking about. Yeah?
So is this just a general thing that can generate any kind of deltas, like 4, 5, 6, 7.
Right. So you can generalize this by adding more arguments here to allow for much more general types of nodes.
Right.
And that can be done, but then it becomes a lot more difficult to actually do calculations because your theory is a lot more complicated. And then your GFT has an action. And this action is typically chosen so that if you do the perturbative expansion of the partition function, this matches the sum over geometries of a spin foam model, which is just the covariant approach to LQG. And for the simplest GFT models, the action for quantum gravity with a massless scalar field, so here I'm going to consider the case where my matter field is a massless scalar field, the dominant terms are the following. So you have some kinetic term here. And then you have some interaction term here, which corresponds to simplicial gravity. That's why you have the phi to the fifth term. And just one point that I want to emphasize here is that there is, because this is a massless scalar field and the potential vanishes, the only dependence on the scalar field label in the action is right here.
So you have two different indices for, oh, you have like var phi and then regular phi.
That's right.
So which one is which?
So var phi is the GFT field, which uh-huh. corresponds to the nodes. And then the normal phi is the matter field.
So what happens if you have lots of nodes? Then where does that appear? I guess that's what I don't see here.
So that will depend on the state. So you'll have your Fock vacuum state, which is essentially the node geometry
right.
state. Then you act with creation operators, and then you'll act with, let's say, n creation operators. That will give you a state with n quantum geometry.
Right. And then how those are connected to each other?
Then you have to impose the connectivity by some projectors. So you create a whole bunch of them,
uh-huh.
and then you connect them by acting with a number of projectors. And each projector will connect one link of this guy with one link from another one. So you need a certain number of projectors if you want to have a completely connected state.
OK, so that's if you want to connect, that makes it you a different state. So
that's right.
OK.
Any other questions? OK. So now let me just introduce one of the operators which will be useful here. I mean, these are all just the standard second quantized operators that you're used to from quantum field theory, but rewritten for these quantum geometry. So one operator that we'll use a lot is the number operator, which is simply var phi dagger var phi. But what's important here is that because we have a scalar field, this allows us to define relational observables. And so for example, we're interested in the relational number operator. So this number operator evaluated at some relational instant of time phi naught, which is just given by var phi dagger at the label phi naught times var phi at the label phi naught. So because we have this matter field, now we can speak of relational observables, something which was a lot more difficult when you were working in the vacuum case. So this is very important because in cosmology, you'll want to speak of dynamics. And for that, we'll need a relational clock. And it's precisely this scalar field which will act as our relational clock. So now I can, yes?
Sorry.
No, of course.
Is that sum over j from 1 to 4 or the j 1 to 4 for every node?
That's right. So here, I'm summing over j1, j2, j3, j4. From 0 to infinity over the half integers.
So it's like j1 to 4 of
yes.
number 1, then j3.
Yeah. So here I'll show you explicitly what I meant by the condensate states that we're interested in. So here we'll focus on a particularly simple family of condensate states, which are the Gross-Butaevsky condensate states. And these are coherent states, the GFT field operator. And if you just drop a numerical prefactor, they have this form here. And so you have the exponential of the creation operator weighted by some function sigma here, which is called the condensate wave function. And one thing that's important here is that the condensate wave function is not normalized. Of course, the state is, right? This state is normalized, but the condensate wave function is not. And what its norm tells us is the number of GFT quanta that you have in that state. So here, this is the specific condensate that I'm looking at.
So you also showed the action for, or the Hamiltonian for how to evolve this?
Yes, the action.
This
yeah.
is the action. So how does the action, use the connectivity information? Or it's not clear to me.
So the connectivity information will modify the state.
Yeah.
And because your equation's of motion will always be the same, right?
Right.
And it's just that your state will be different, so its dynamics will be different. That's something that we haven't yet investigated. So
right.
That's something that I'm...
This kind of looks like, I mean, the first term looks like the free action.
That's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you said phi to the fifth is interaction.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess different nodes have to interact with each other somehow. And that's through the five.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So I will make some speculations about that later. Right now, we're working with an unconnected state. And I can show exactly what happens there. And I have some ideas of what may happen when you start including the connectivity. But I haven't shown that yet, but I'll get back to that later. Okay, and as I was already saying, the massless scalar field can be used as a relational clock. So I can speak of the condensate wave function evaluated at some relational time, phi naught. And so if I impose my quantum equations of motion on this condensate state sigma here, this will give some relational dynamics with respect to my matter field. Okay. Now my condensate state is entirely determined, once I'm working in the family of Gross-Butaevsky states, by this condensate wave function sigma. So I need to decide what sigma I want to use. And now I'm going to make some choices so that my condensate state represents a cosmological spacetime. And of course, if I can make some clever approximations, this will simplify the equations that I want to solve. So first of all, we're going to work with a state which we think corresponds to the spatially flat FLRW spacetime, so absolutely the simplest spacetime that you can think of. So here, we're going to neglect connectivity. And this is because the main observable that we're interested in is the total volume. And for this, we don't need to know what the connectivity is. We just need to know the volume at each node and what nodes there are. And furthermore, because the spacetime is spatially flat, we don't need to try to encode spatial curvature in the connectivity of the graph. So if we want to go beyond spatially flat FLRW spacetimes, look at the closed or the open case, then it may be important to include some connectivity information. So that's something that we have to, that remains to be done.
Is that possible that, I mean, the flat space, it looks to me everything is connected, but then if you say nothing is connected to anything, then.
Right. So here, of course, we want it to be connected, right? So it really is connected, but that information isn't necessary to encode the physics that we're interested in. So we just ignore that information.
Okay.
Right? So it's not that it's not connected, it's that we neglect that information entirely to make the calculations a lot easier.
But I guess there's a difference between neglecting and ignoring. I don't know if
that's... Yeah, perhaps.
Whether it's a small and you forget about it, or it's just you it's there but you don't care about it.
Yeah, so. Here's the second case.
Yeah.
And also, we're only interested in isotropic observables. So what we're going to do is we're going to restrict our attention to equilateral or isotropic configurations. What this means is that we're looking at these tetrahedra, and we're going to assume that all of these tetrahedra, or these spin network nodes, are isotropic. And that means that if I have these labels here, these ji and the mi, I choose the j's and the m's to be the same on all the links. So I only have one label j that's left. And I choose the intertwiner such that it maximizes the volume. And this also corresponds to the isotropic case for the tetrahedron. So now I only have one label that's left by restricting attention to these equilateral configurations. And this is what you'd expect also coming from full LQC, where you only have these minimal excitations. Right? You're also led to this. So this is more general than that, but goes in the same direction. OK, so this is the state that I'm interested in. And now I can start looking at its dynamics. And so the quantum equations of motion are simply this. So this will be the same for any state. But of course, when we work with condensate states, these are usually only approximate solutions to the equations of motion. And so requiring this is too much. So what we're going to do is we're only going to impose the first Schwinger Dyson equation, which is just that the expectation value of this operator vanished. So this is something which is much weaker. Of course, then it's important to make sure the other terms will be small. So for the GFT action that I showed you earlier, this gives you the following nonlinear equations of motion for the condensate wave function, sigma j. And here I just have some numerical values, mj squared and wj, which just depend on the parameters in the GFT action. So their exact form, the exact functional dependence here is quite complicated. It's not important here. All you need to know is that once you give me a GFT action, then I can calculate what these parameters are for each J for this type of state.
What do they depend on?
So they depend on the GFT action that you start with. So given this GFT action, I know these K2 terms, I know this a V5 term.
Yeah, but it's K2 function of phi or?
Right.
J?
So this K2 here depends on the J's and the M's and the intertwiner. Here there's a dependence on the matter field. And then there's some dependence on the J's, the M's, and the intertwiner here. And here there'll be some dependence on the J's, the M's, and the intertwiners. But this will depend on your GFT model. So if you have different GFT models, then perhaps you'll make different choices here. And then given your choices for these terms in your action, then you have specific values of mj squared and wj. So this is the equation of motion that we have to solve. But before solving it, we have to keep in mind that we're looking at Gross-Pitevsky condensates. And this is a very specific type of state. Now, these are approximate solutions, which are typically most trustworthy when the interactions are small. So here, for the remainder of my talk, I'm going to focus on the case when the interaction term is negligible. If you consider cases when the interaction term becomes important, it might be necessary to go beyond the Gross-Pitevsky approximations and start to include interactions or connectivity information. And this isn't because this equation is hard to solve. I mean, this you can add this term and still solve the equation, of course. The problem is that we're not sure whether the Gross-Pitevsky ansatz is reliable once this term starts to become important. Yes?
So can I understand the physical meaning of this sigma j? So it's some sort of a, because when I'm thinking about the superfluid, I guess it's something like the density of particles.
Yes.
Right? So what is it here?
So here, it will tell you about the total number of particles, or quanta, of geometry. So if you look at the norm, sigma j squared, let's say you evaluate it at some instant of relational time, that will tell you how many quanta of geometry you have at that instant of relational time.
So j would be the number of quantum geometries, or?
OK, so
if I plot, as for a given phi, I plot sigma of j as a function of j.
Right.
The peak tells me what is the most likely?
J, exactly.
J.
But so
j is like a two-dimensional area, isn't it? Or
no, j is a quantum number.
Right. But what is the physical meaning of that?
OK, so what that means is I have some spin network node here,
yeah,
and it has four links. Mm-hmm. And I have j on each of those links.
Right.
And then each of those areas, so this corresponds to some tetrahedron, where all of the areas now go like the square root of j times j plus 1 times the Planck length squared.
Right, OK.
Yeah. So what that's
area per each, I guess, vertex.
Exactly.
Right? OK.
Yeah.
How does that tell me like the volume of the universe or a scale factor?
So because this is a tetrahedron, then from the area, you can figure out what the volume is.
But I don't know how many of these there are. I mean, this is
right, that's what sigma j tells you. So sigma j squared, that tells you the number of tetrahedra with some j there.
Right.
So by calculating this, then I can calculate the total volume.
So to get the total volume of the universe, I have to integrate over j.
Yeah.
And multiply by j cubed or something like that.
Exactly. J to the 3 halves, yeah.
J to the 3 halves, right.
Yeah. That's exactly it. OK. So as I was saying, in the Gross-Pitevsky approximation, this is most trustworthy when the interactions are small. So that's where I want to focus on for the remainder. But if we go back, you can easily check that the equations of motion for the constant wave function, the interaction term becomes large when the norm of sigma j is large. And this is what we were just talking about. That means you have many, many quanta, so you have a large volume. And what this tells us is that interactions become important at large volumes. And this goes back to your question about connectivity, that here our interactions are becoming important at large volumes. And I think it may be because the connectivity information has been ignored. And so what's happening is that if we go back to the GFT action, because you're ignoring the connectivity, all of these quanta are interacting with each other. But if you include the connectivity, then perhaps then each quantum will only interact with its nearest neighbors. And that will make this term much smaller. But at this point, this is just a hypothesis. We have to go through and check to see whether this will be the case or not. But in any case, it is clear that when the norm of sigma j becomes large, the interaction term becomes large, and then the Gross-Vitebsky approximation may not be trustworthy. So from now on, I'm just going to consider the mesoscopic regime where the interactions are small, so I can neglect the interaction term, but we still have enough quanta to speak of some continuum space-time interpretation. Now, a mesoscopic regime of this type will exist for some GFT actions depending on the parameters in the action. So now I will work with a GFT action which allows a mesoscopic regime of this type and see what happens in this regime. So of course, eventually we want to be able to go beyond this and include connectivity and hopefully be able to look at large volumes also.
So it is parameter as MJ and WJ. How are they related to, I guess, the LQT parameters? I guess it would be Planck mass and emergency parameter. Are they related?
They are, but in a rather complicated way. Uh-huh. So what you have to do is you have to look at your spin flow model, uh-huh. and you'll have vertex amplitudes and edge amplitudes.
Right.
And then those are related. So your vertex amplitude will be related to this guy. Uh-huh. And your edge amplitude will be related to this guy here. And then from those, you can then calculate the mj squared and the wj term from here.
Okay.
So you have to go from the your spin flow model and know your vertex terms and your edge terms, translate that into your GFT action, and then from the GFT action and figure out what these terms are by working with this state.
OK, and the answer is, or is it something that can be done or cannot be done?
It can be done.
OK.
Yeah.
So are these related to, do you know how they're related to Planck?
Not off the top of my head, no.
The action of group field action is related to a specific spin flow model?
Yes.
Is there like a one-one correspondence?
Yes.
Which one do you choose here?
Well, you can choose whichever one you want. Here, we're working with, we're using some structures which correspond to the EPRL model. But in principle, you can work with whichever one you want.
But you want one that has this mesoscopic regime?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. OK. So in this mesoscopic regime, first I'm going to rewrite my Condorcet wave function in terms of its magnitude and some phase. Then your Condorcet equations of motion imply that for each j, you have two conserved quantities with respect to the relational time. And that's just this, we could call it a GFT energy, and then a U1 symmetry. And these are conserved quantities. And you can see that directly from the equations of motion. After this, you also have one remaining non-trivial equation of motion for each j, which is given by this. And remember that this q here is that constant. And what's important is that rho j can never become 0 because of this divergent repulsive potential here at rho j equals to 0. Right. So now that I have my dynamics for my Condorcet state, I want to go and start looking at cosmology. And so I want to extract the dynamics of some collective observables from this Condorcet state. And so what I want to do now is to relate the volume, spatial volume, and the momentum of the scalar field to the appropriate GFT observables. And this is what we were just talking about. So the volume at some instant of time is just you sum over all the j, then the volume of that equilateral tetrahedron times the number that you have, right? The rho j squared. And you can define a similar operator for the momentum of the massless scalar field at some instant of relational time. It has this form. And a straightforward calculation shows you that the momentum of your massless scalar field is just the sum over j of the qjs. And this directly shows us that the momentum of the massless scalar field is conserved in relational time. And this is precisely the continuity equation for a Friedmann spacetime with a massless scalar field. So we recover that one right away. The other equation that we want to recover is, of course, the Friedmann equation. And for this, we need to know how the volume changes with respect to the relational clock. So what we're interested in is the derivative of the volume with respect to the scalar field divided by the volume all squared. This is essentially your Hubble rate in the relational time. And it's easy to check that this is the relationship that you get just by using the relation above. And what we're interested in now is to look at the semi-classical limit, make sure that we recover GR in some way. And here, a thing that's important to keep in mind is that we're using the scalar field as our relational clock. So the Friedmann equation in that case has this form in classical GR. And you can see immediately that in the low curvature semi-classical limit, which it, for Friedmann spacetimes corresponds to large volume or large rho j, then we recover exactly this. That's because under this square root, this term dominates, the mj squared rho j squared term dominates. And then the sum over vj rho j squared cancels, and you're left with the sum over j of mj squared times 2/3.
Sorry, what is rho j?
So rho j is the magnitude of sigma j.
Okay.
Yeah. So here I'm looking at the large volume limit, which happens when you have many, many quanta, which means that rho j is large.
So when is that thing you have, what had the square root? Where did that come from?
So the square root comes from, so here we're interested in this evolution of V with respect to the scalar field. So we have this term that shows up there. And we had this conserved quantity Ej, which has this form. So I'm just taking the square root to isolate this guy.
So that conserved quantity, where did that come from?
So that is, if you look at this equation of motion, right, you can see that if you think of the mass of scalar field as a relational time, this has some energy, right, which is conserved.
Right.
So it's just that energy.
I don't quite see that. So if you so for is that true for every j? Okay.
Yeah. So this equation holds for each j.
Okay. The different j's don't talk to each other.
No.
Okay.
And that's
So this is just the second order different. It's like a harmonic. No, it's not even a harmonic oscillator.
Well, it's some oscillator here with some extra
oscillator.
Potential.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So it's an aharmonic oscillator.
Yeah.
Right. Good.
Yeah.
It's just energy as a harmonic.
Yes, exactly.
MJ, you said, is roughly the ratio between the GFT propagator of this, like the geometry and the scalar.
That's right. Yeah. Now, if I just go back there, so this term is pure geometry, but this term will have some geometry part to it also. But yeah, so that's right. It's the ratio of these two terms that gives you mj squared. Yeah.
What does it mean? Did you understand what it means, that condition that should be take this value or be constant or something?
Well, what it's telling us, I think, is how to encode the kinetic term of a scalar field in a GFT. So if you want to have the correct semi-classical limit, you have to have a specific relationship between these two terms. So if you have a vacuum GFT, then you know what this term is. And then you know if I want to add a mass to scalar field, then I have to add this extra term with a given weighting. So I think it's just telling us how to include a scalar field. Yeah. OK. So I had this equation for my volume, and it gives me the correct Friedmann equation in the low curvature semi-classical limit. So this is good, but we can do a little bit more. If we remember the what we had left, our last non-trivial equation of motion for rho j, as I already stated, rho j never reaches zero because of this repulsive potential at rho j equals to zero.
So where did that come from, that repulsive potential?
Okay, so that comes from so here, if you rewrite sigma j in terms of its magnitude and phase, then you'll have two equations that come that follow from that.
Oh, okay.
Right? And one of them will tell you that this qj term is a constant of the motion.
Right.
And the other one has this form here.
So rho j is the number of nodes, right?
That's right. Well, rho j squared, yeah.
So you're saying that there is at least one node of each j?
There doesn't have to be. There doesn't have to be. So rho j could be equal to zero for a given j. Right? But of course, if you want to have some non-zero volume, then at least for one j naught, rho j has to be different from zero. At least one.
That's this equation diverge with the rho is zero, not this one.
So here, if you have, so remember you have this sum here, right? So you can have some rho j being equal to zero for specific values.
On the previous page or the next page. Yeah, that's
so here, if rho j is equal to zero, then qj is also equal to zero. Mm-hmm. So you're okay.
Okay, but qj is quadratic in rho j, but this x of 10 is
So you have rho j squared here, and you square it, you have rho j to the fourth, so you're fine.
Okay.
So it's kind of like saying that you have just a harmonic oscillator, but then in two dimensions, but then you go to polar coordinates.
Exactly.
And that's like an angular momentum barrier.
Exactly. Yeah. It's exactly that. OK. And because of this barrier, rho j never becomes zero. And remember that the volume in terms of relational time has this form. So of course, your volume can never be zero either.
So why did it have a square of rho j? I thought rho j was sigma j squared already. So.
No, that's just the, so I just rewrite sigma j as rho j with e to the i theta j.
Rho j is just amplitude.
Yeah.
Right, but here you just told me that it doesn't diverge because q constant zero. So why do you say now that it's diverged if rho cannot be zero?
Okay, so rho can be zero for some j's. But for at least one j naught, it has to be non-zero. And there, your qj also has to be non-zero if you want to have some matter content.
Okay.
Right? Because your matter content is measured by the momentum of your massless scalar field. And that's the sum over qj. So if you set all the qj is equal to zero, then you have no scalar field.
Okay.
And then that won't correspond to a cosmological space-time. So we see from this that because vj is never zero, v is never zero either. And also, just by looking at this equation here, you can tell that there are only minus signs here. There's nothing that will keep your rho j close, right? So if you think of this as some particle with some angular momentum barrier, there's no attractive force to keep it there afterwards. So it'll just come in close and then leave. So we have a bounce.
But it depends on the sign of m s squared, so I don't know.
That's right. That's right. Here I'm assuming that it's mj squared is positive, but you're right. It depends on that.
And that was just my assumption from the beginning. To recover the Friedmann equation, did you need?
Yes. So to recover the Friedmann equation, I needed mj squared to be 3 pi g.
Okay. Good. So mj is related to Planck constant.
Yes. Okay. So what I've shown you is that by working with this type of condensate state, I recover the correct semi-classical limit, and I also resolve the singularity by a bounce. But now I can do something more. I can further restrict the state so that it matches LQC as much as possible, or at least the heuristic picture that we have of LQC. So as I showed you earlier, LQC in its construction suggests that the appropriate condensate state that corresponds to it is the one where all the quanta are equilateral spin network nodes, which is what we were already doing, but furthermore, that they all correspond to the minimal volume or minimal area spin network nodes. So with j equals to 1/2 everywhere. So what we can do now is that we can consider the case where the constant wave function now only has support on one j equals to j naught. So it's zero everywhere else, and then for one value of j, it has some value which we can then solve for. Okay? And so for LQC, you would actually choose this j naught to be equal to 1/2, but we can keep leave this a little bit more general.
If you fix it to 1/2, half would the universe expand then?
The universe would expand by increasing the number of quanta of geometry.
I see. All right.
Okay. And so I won't show you the equation again, but if you go back, you had the Freeman equation that had sums in the numerator and the denominator. So in this case, if you only have support on one value, the sums trivialize, and then your equation of motion is very simple. And this is the form that you get. And now here, this row without a subscript j is just the energy density of my mass scalar field. And my condensate Freeman equation becomes this. And here, we can just ignore this last term for now. This term here is exactly what you get in loop quantum cosmology, with this rho c being the critical energy density. And this is essentially the Planck energy density, with some dependence on the j naught that you choose. And so this is exactly what you get from LQC, modulo this extra term, which depends on this constant of the motion, EJ naught. Now, this is something that you choose in your initial conditions. So of course, you can choose a state where EJ naught is equal to zero, and then this term vanishes, and you get exactly LQC. But in general, you may want to have something which is different, and then you have this small departure from.
But shouldn't it be positive at EJ naught?
No, that's free. I'm pretty sure.
If you went back to your definition.
So there's this term here. So it could be negative.
It's a repulsive, right?
Yeah.
So what's the physical meaning of this additional term?
So that's a good question. And I don't have a good answer for that. Its effect here is very clear. It simply changes the energy scale at which the bounce occurs. Now, the bounce is robust, right? Because this term is stronger. This one goes as 1 over v squared. So this one will dominate. You know, definitely have a bounce no matter what. But this will change the energy scale at which the bounce occurs. So its effect on the dynamics is clear. But its physical interpretation is not. And I don't know what that corresponds to in the emergent space-time.
Dark matter.
Well, perhaps. Perhaps.
But actually, it does scale like dark matter, matter of volume. But I don't understand why.
Well, here,
Because I mean,
it's not obvious to me here because remember that this is a different choice of lapse. It's not lapse equals to one.
No, but I'm just comparing it to density, right? So, I mean, density for dark matter goes as 1/volume or 1/ scale factor cube.
Yes, but here you have a lapse equal to the volume. So dark matter should actually go like volume here. Because there's a, right, you have, so this, sorry, this here is the term that corresponds classically to your mass scalar field.
Rho c is the constant. Rho is the density of the scalar field. Right?
That's right, but this is the quantum gravity correction term here.
Oh.
So the classical limit is just 4g over 3.
I see.
Right?
I see.
And that's just because we're working with a different lapse, which corresponds to V.
Okay, no, I understand.
Yeah.
Okay. So rho c, okay, so the 1 is really the classical contribution.
That's right.
So this is 1/ volume correction to 1.
That's right.
Right.
So yeah, it's some weird matter field, but unfortunately it's not dark matter. So this is what I just said. It affects the dynamics of the constant, but its geometrical interpretation is not clear. OK, so let me conclude. So motivated by some simple arguments, as well as some insights from LQC, we made a very specific onslaught on the type of state in the GFQ reformulation of LQG. of what should correspond to cosmological spacetimes, and this was that we should look at GFT Kong's states, and specifically Gross-Pietaevsky ones in this case. Now, the equations of motion for this state are determined by the GFT action, and then we can look at their hydrodynamics by looking at collective observables, and that gives us the continuity and Friedmann equations. These have the appropriate semi-classical limit if you choose the parameters in the GFT action so that mj squared is equal to 3 pi g. And in the emergent dynamics, we find that the classical singularity is resolved and is generically replaced by a bounce, and also that for a very specific choice of the condensate state, which is suggested by LQC, we recover almost exactly the LQC effect of Friedmann equations. So I think this is quite encouraging, but there's a huge amount that remains to be done. So first of all, I think it's important to study other condensate wave functions going beyond the Gross-Pietaevsky approximation, also to consider different GFT actions. So here we just considered a very simple case. It would also be interesting to look at the details of the semi-classical regime at late times, and Stefan has done some interesting work on that, showing that for a certain class of GFT actions, the j equals to 1/2 spin term dominates at late times. So this is one way that we can see that we're getting a nice semi-classical limit. Now here, we just looked at the first Schrödinger-Dyson equation, so of course it's important to go to the higher order ones and calculate the error there and make sure that this error is small. Also, here I focused on a massless scalar field, so we want to extend this to allow for a non-vanishing potential, and also to include spatial curvature, anisotropies, perturbations, and so on. Here I was really focusing on the mesoscopic regime, and so it's important to go beyond that and to study the regime where these interactions become large, and some work in this direction has been done by Mary and her group. And I think one of the most important things is to understand how to include connectivity information in the analysis. So here, we neglected that based on some considerations, but also just so that the calculations would be a lot easier. Once you start including connectivity information, the calculations become much more complicated. So that's a very important thing to do, and I think it may be necessary to do that if we want to include spatial curvature and anisotropies or perturbations. And also, I'd like to try to better understand the physical interpretation of this EJ term that shows up in the Friedmann equations. So thank you very much for your attention.
Ms. Jones.
So if you, can you go back to your modified Friedmann equation?
Yep. This one or the more?
That's the one, yeah. So this density is, I guess, would go as 1 over a cubed, 1 over volume a square, right?
Of the mass of scalar field?
Yeah.
It'll go over 1 over volume squared or 1 over 8 to 6, yeah.
Okay, so so you have that, and then you have the 1 over v term there. And that energy could be positive or negative, it looks like, right?
That's EJ, no? Yes, that's right. That's right.
So I'm just trying to see whether you can't necessarily get a bounce independent of what EV is.
Yes. So here, so you have two quantum gravity correction terms. You have this term here, and you have this term here. So these are essentially all constants over V. And these are all constants over V squared, because you have a V squared term here.
Right, okay.
So at small volume, this term will dominate. So you necessarily have a bounce.
Okay. Yeah. And then if you don't restrict your J to the 1/2, J equal to 1/2, then I guess you have the more general Friedmann equation?
That's right. You have this one here.
Okay. Okay, but you cannot actually solve that because it depends on all EJs.
Well, I mean, you can make some choice, and then you can solve it numerically. Analytically, it's not so obvious.
But the problem is there is not, I mean, there are infinite number of variables, and you have just one equation.
That's right. I mean, you have initial conditions for each EJ and each QJ. Yeah.
So this is not the equation you should be solving. You should go back to the original Schrödinger, or whatever, this equation.
So
you have to solve this one.
Right. Yeah, exactly, for each J. So if you give me some input and you say, well, I think that the appropriate quantum state has such and such a form, then you can put that in here in quantum dynamics. But I agree, you need some input.
MJ should all be the same. Is that what I've done?
OK, so here, in what I've done, if you go here, you recover the correct classical Friedmann equation for this. Now, that's sufficient, but it's not necessary. So there are other ways that you can recover the correct Friedmann equation. And in particular, this is what Stefan has shown, is that if you work with a specific type of GFT action, then where at late times only one spin dominates, then you just need the MJ of that spin to give that. And then that's enough. So it depends on the GFT action you're working with. But this is certainly sufficient, depending on the GFT action and the other ways.
If you have multiple Js, then would they all bounce at the same time, or would they? I mean, I guess there is no reason to come to the initial condition.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, in the general case, certainly, the behavior of the bounce is highly dependent on the initial condition. So
right.
You can make general statements about late times and these results that somehow this the Friedmann equation of the classical theory emerges at late times, that seems quite generic.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly what happens around the bounds would depend very highly on the initial conditions.
I mean, the existence of the bounce is robust, but the actual dynamics of the bounce depends strongly on initial conditions.
All right.
And I don't know if it's a, if the question makes sense
mm-hmm.
as such, but how non-trivial it is to get exactly the LQC term in the Friedmann equation? So is it something you can expect? Because, I don't know, on some general basis, you understand why it happened, so it's more like, magic, I get the right factors, the right signs, and no rho square, but just a linear one. So,
yeah. It's not obvious to me. What makes me think that this is actually quite strong is that it has essentially the right dependence in J0. So you expect that if your J naught is larger, that means that your discreteness scale is larger, so you expect quantum graphics to become important sooner. Right? So if you have some quanta, which instead of being Planck scale, or let's say 1,000 times the Planck scale, then you expect the quantum graphics to become important 1,000 times before you reach the Planck scale. And that's exactly what happens here. And that's what you'd also expect from LQC. So the convergence of these things is quite nice to me. Now, the fact that you get the 1 over v squared term here with a rho c, which is almost identical to LQC, is encouraging. But what I would really like to do is try and go back to this with different matter fields and make sure we get something similar. Because, I mean, so far we just looked at the massless scalar field case. So it's encouraging, but I don't want to draw conclusions that are too strong yet before checking other cases and making sure we get something similar.
But the numerical factor defined in rho c are not exactly the same as in it.
Not exactly, because what matters here is the volume. So the volume of the tetrahedron. Whereas in LQC, what matters is the area.
Yeah,
and then what shows up here is the area to the three halves, essentially, in LQC. And those two things are not exactly identical.
But in LQC, there's also no J naught. Oyster.
Right, so for LQC, you just set J0 equal to 1/2. But yes, that's right. So in LQC, you have a very specific value here, which here you try to match that J0 equal to 1/2.
Else?
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.